Welcome back to the second half of this week's episode. I hope you had an enjoyable break.
I hope yours was as well.
It was now, so restful.
Before we start with Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, I do have a trivia question.
Ooh,
here.
Okay.
So, Michael Caine, who is one of the stars of this movie, and Anton Rogers, who plays one of the supporting roles in this movie, had appeared together the year before in a movie, and 15 years before Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Anton Rogers appeared in a movie that Michael Caine wanted a part in, but he was ultimately turned down for. And both of these movies are based on novels by the same author. Who was the author and what were the names of those two movies? I'll have the answer at the end of this half of the episode. But right now, Claude is going to give us the plot description for Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Oh, that's a lot of stuff. Okay, let me introduce our two main characters before we start. We've got Lawrence Jameson, who's played by Michael Caine. He's an intelligent and sophisticated British con artist. And with the help of his manservant Arthur, played by Ian McDiarmid, and rather amoral police official Andre, played by Anton Rogers, he seduces wealthy women and he cons them out of money by posing as a prince in exile trying to raise money for his country's quote-unquote freedom fighters. The film opens on a woman whose face we don't see taking off her pearls to hand over to an also unseen Lawrence, with him feigning protest until finally, caving in and taking them from her. The story itself begins with Lawrence and Andre setting up the scam on a wealthy woman named Fanny Eubank. She's played by Barbara Harris. And they're later seen dividing up the spoils before escaping on a train to the fictional town of Beaumont-sur-Mer. While on the train, Lawrence spots a small-time American hustler named Freddie Benson. He's played by Steve Martin. His version of the same scam is a sob story about a sick grandmother. Now, Lawrence thinks that Freddie's tactics are kind of clumsy, and also they're rather small-time, as I mentioned. And so he's thinking maybe if Freddie could conceivably scare away his own larger fish targets there. So Lawrence attempts to trick Freddie into choosing a different destination, and he manages to succeed briefly when Andre hires a woman to divert him to Portofino. The next morning, Andre notes to Lawrence that there's another scammer in town known as the Jackal. Lawrence isn't too worried about this guy, though, and Andre gives Lawrence the information on their next target. But shortly thereafter, they spot Freddie in the car with that woman. Lawrence gets Andre to approach the woman with evidence that Freddie is a con man. So Freddie is arrested and put on a plane out of town. However, after Freddie meets Fanny Eubanks on the plane, he blackmails Lawrence into taking him on as a pupil. We get a montage during which Lawrence attempts to teach Freddie style and refinement with, let's call it, limited success. He then involves Freddie in his cons, having him play a mentally challenged brother, Ruprecht, to scare away women that Lawrence has seduced and now, in the brand new con, proposed to. However, when Lawrence refuses to give Freddie a cut of the profits because he considers Freddie to be an unpaid apprentice, well, Freddie quits. It turns out that having Freddie play Ruprecht was also a scam. It was part of an attempt to make him quit. But Freddie isn't done scamming women, and he's not inclined to leave town. Lawrence is unwilling to share his territory with Freddie, so the two agree on a bet. The first to get $50,000 out of a selected mark wins, and the other one has to get out of town. So they target new arrival Janet Colgate. She is a rather naive United States soap queen, played by Glenn Headley. Freddie poses as a crippled U.S. Navy veteran. He starts with the grandmother scam, but then escalates it to saying that his need for a wheelchair is psychosomatic, and for treatment by the celebrated psychiatrist Dr. Emil Schufhausen of Liechtenstein would cost $50,000. When Janet shows sympathy to Freddie, Lawrence poses as Dr. Schufhausen and agrees to treat Freddie, but stipulates that Janet pay the $50,000 fee directly to him. Under the guise of continuing Freddie's treatment, Lawrence dances with Janet and taunts Freddie, which raises the ire of some nearby British sailors, whom Freddie convinces to waylay Lawrence later that evening. Lawrence discovers that Janet is not actually a wealthy soap heiress. In fact, she won her vacation and soap queen title in a contest. However, she is planning on liquidating most of her assets to pay for Freddie's treatment. Now, because he cons only wealthy women, Lawrence tries to cancel the bet. But Freddie instead comes up with a new bet. Janet herself will be the bet. The first one to have sex with her will be declared the winner. Lawrence says no, he refuses to seduce Janet, but he does agree to bet on whether or not Freddie succeeds. As they arrive at Lawrence's place, the sailors grab Lawrence with the intent of taking him to the airport and dropping him into a departing plane. Freddie then rushes up to Janet's hotel room, where he demonstrates his love by standing up miraculously and walking to her. However, Lawrence was secretly present the whole time and declares Freddie to be cured. In the hallway later, Lawrence explains that the sailors let him go after they discovered that he himself is a Royal Naval Reserve officer. Lawrence leaves Freddie at a party with the sailors who, realizing that he can walk, haze him and keep him occupied until Lawrence can put Janet on an airplane home. When Lawrence returns to the hotel, Freddie is getting along famously with the sailors, but they've also superglued him to the wall. Lawrence bids him auf Wiedersehen and leaves. Freddie goes back up to Janet's room and finds her gone. Moments later, though, Janet turns up in the room. She says she couldn't leave, and she declares her love for him. They kiss, and they begin undressing. Andre reports this to Lawrence, who accepts his defeat graciously, and he waits for Freddie to return and gloat over the victory. But it's Janet who shows up instead. She's in tears, and she says Freddie stole the money that her father sent. Not only that, she suspects that Freddie could walk the entire time. Lawrence is disgusted, so he calls Andre to have Freddie arrested. He gives Janet a bag with $50,000 cash out of his own safe, and he takes her to the airport. Before the plane departs, Janet returns Lawrence's bag, refusing to take what isn't hers. Andre arrives with Freddie, who claims that Janet stole his wallet and clothes. Lawrence doesn't believe him. He's like, look, Janet's honest. She returned the $50,000. But when he opens the bag, he finds that the money has been replaced with Freddie's clothes and a note from Janet revealing she's the jackal. Freddie is furious, but Lawrence is absolutely delighted at their both having been deceived so skillfully. A week later, Freddie and Lawrence sit at his villa and they contemplate their loss, and they're about to part ways for good when Janet, posing as a New York City real estate agent, arrives in a yacht filled with wealthy people. She prompts the startled Lawrence and Freddie to assume roles in her new scheme, and then, after sending her guests up to the house to refresh themselves and their beverages, takes the pair aside and announces that while she made $3 million the previous year, well, your $50,000 was the most fun. The three link arms, and under the closing credits, they head up to the house to fleece their newest victims.
Okay, so this is a remake of a 1964 movie called Bedtime Story. So this is the only remake that we're doing where the original had a different title. It was directed by a man by the name of Ralph Levy and starred David Niven as Lawrence Jamison, Marlon Brando as Freddie Benson, and Shirley Jones as Janet, although in this movie her last name is Walker rather than Colgate. Now, of all the remakes that we're discussing, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is the one that sticks the closest to the original, and the fact that it follows the same story beats. The dialogue is different in a lot of cases. And of course, the music that plays in the bar when Janet and Lawrence are dancing together is much different as well, being from the 80s. But the movies are very similar as far as the plot go until the last 10-15 minutes. In the original version, Janet finds out that Dr. Emil, the identity that Lawrence is assuming, is actually dead. That was a real person, that he died. And so she does go back to Freddie And she ends up marrying him. And Freddie finds that he's not looking forward to becoming a husband and giving up his con artistry life for good. And this is one of the reasons why this is different for me than the other remakes that we're talking about. The original version of The Man Who Knew Too Much and the original versions of the two movies that we're talking about in the next episode, while I prefer the remakes, the originals are by no means bad movies. They are watchable, whereas I think Bedtime Story is a bad movie, or at least one that I don't like at all. For one thing, I don't like the ending, and I will concede that in both the case of The Man Who Knew Too Much and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, I saw the remake first, which might color my judgment somewhat, but I don't think Ralph Levy directs the original very well. He certainly doesn't know how to shoot it to get the comedy, to bring the comedy out. Marlon Brando would later say that he was never any good at comedy. And while I think that later in his career, in two comedies that he appeared in, The Freshman and Don Juan DeMarco, he showed he was capable of comedy. He doesn't show it in this movie. And also, while this is admittedly true of a lot of sex comedies that were made in the 60s, the tone of Bedtime Story I find very smug and, not funny at all. Whereas Dirty Rotten Scoundrels I find very funny for reasons that we're going to discuss. And I loved the ending for reasons that we're also going to discuss. Now, Claude, from the facial expressions you were making, I gather you haven't seen Bedtime Story at all?
I have. I saw it a while ago. I did see it a while back. And you're right. It just kind of, it wasn't quite as funny as they thought it was, if that makes sense. Like, you just kind of see where there's like a little bit of a wink and a nod. It's like, no, I'm not getting this joke. I am curious, because now Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is actually the meat in a remake sandwich here, because this was remade again as The Hustle. Okay, yes. Starring Anne Hathaway and
Rebel Wilson. Yeah. And Alex Sharp. And I did not see that version.
So it was a gender flip besides. So.
Yeah, nor did I see the Broadway musical that was made off of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels with John Lithgow in the Lawrence Jamison role. But do you think Dirty Rotten Scoundrels was funny?
It was. It definitely was funny. And yeah. I think one of the things that made it especially funny was that I think that Steve Martin and Michael Caine were given a lot of latitude to do their thing. All right. But the other thing is not just that, because, Michael Caine, he's very good at what he does. But it reminded me a little bit of like the television version of The Odd Couple, in the sense that Jack Klugman had this way of just kind of standing there and doing practically nothing while Tony Randall was all over the place. And that made the both of them that much funnier. And you got the same kind of vibe from here, where Steve Martin was allowed to do, he was like in a very manic kind of Steve Martin kind of thing. And it's the sort of stuff that you kind of remember from his stand-up, where he would do like Happy Feet and things like that, and just being all over the place. And Caine is just kind of standing there sort of taking it in and doing his lines and whatever else. And it works just because of the contrast between the two. The both of them are made funnier by just letting them do what they do.
Well, I was going to get to the improvisations a little later.
I'm not even on the improvisation, just letting them do, like giving them a little bit of freedom to be, a little bit more, like even if it's on the page, okay, the fact is that Martin went this way, Caine went that way, and it was still just that much funnier.
Right. Well, you can tell that from Martin's first scene when he's putting on this act about his grandmother, and Oz and the cinematographer, who I'm going to talk about in a moment as well, cut to Kane, and he's got that whole "you got to be kidding me"
yeah.
look on his face. And so that's really good. Now, believe it or not, though, we almost didn't have the two of them together in this movie. Originally, this was designed as a vehicle for David Bowie and Mick Jagger.
I did hear about
because
that.
Because apparently they had gotten a lot of heat off of the music video that they did together for Live Aid, or right after Live Aid, their cover version of Martha Reeves and the Vandellas Dancing in the Street, which a lot of people younger than us find funny for all the wrong reasons. But anyway,
especially if you watch it without audio.
Yes, but it was thought that Dale Lawner, who wrote the remake, although both the original writers were credited on this, which is another thing, Paul Henning and Stanley Shapiro, which is another thing that distinguishes this from the other remakes, in that it's not, you know, based on a story by, this is, you know, screenplay by Dale Lawner, Stanley Shapiro, and Paul Henning, which doesn't appear in any of the other remakes we're talking about. But Dale Lawner, when he was writing this and when he was developing this, eventually Bowie and Jagger, for various reasons, most likely schedule reasons, dropped out. And I can't imagine anyone else playing the roles. I've always been curious as to which of the roles Bowie would play and which role Jagger would play. I would imagine that Bowie would play Lawrence Jameson and Jagger would play Freddie Benson. Although
yeah, I think so.
It'd be kind of interesting to see them try and swap that. Another possibility that was put forth was John Cleese was going to play Lawrence Jameson, and Eddie Murphy would have played Freddie Benson. Now, this was around the time when I started to sour on Murphy's movies, but that might have been an interesting combination. And Cleese and Bowie both regretted turning down the role or having to drop out of the projects. But you're right. The way that Kane and Martin work together is part of what makes this so funny. And not only were they given a lot of leeway, Martin was allowed to improvise things, and Oz would let him go right up to the point that he needed him to stop. For example, in the jail scene where Freddie has been jailed because of fleecing money from the woman, when he's trying to remember Lawrence's name, that was all Martin's improv. And Frank Oz was kneeling right by Anton Rogers, and he would tap the floor when he wanted Rogers to respond so that he could continue on with the scene. And Martin would know that that was his cue to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And Martin also came up with things like having his hand glued, super glued to the wall. And also, when Martin learned that Glenn Headley did a very good New York City accent, that was his idea to end the movie with her, you know, coming up with all those people. One of them, by the way, is played by Louis Zorich, who, what TV show was he on? Remind me again.
Louis Zorich was, he was in Mad About You. He was one of the parents.
That's right. He played Paul Reiser's father, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and he's one of the folks, he's the one standing next to Janet when she's pitching his idea. And, you know, when Martin told her about that, told Frank Oz about that, that's when they whipped up the ending. And so, yes, Martin does a lot of great physical comedy here.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it is just on the side of not being completely disgusting as when he urinates in his pants. And you can tell that just by his the expression on his face. But, you know, whether he's running around the room yelling out, Oklahoma, Oklahoma, or when he's first makes his way onto Lawrence's spread, for lack of a better word. And Lawrence says, you know, what do you want, Freddie? And he says, this is what I want. This. You know, all that is great. And of course, Kane does great by underplaying against all of that. And then also, when Freddie first comes in to the casino in the wheelchair, and Lawrence looks at him and does a very subtle double take.
Yeah.
It's like, you gotta be another, you gotta be kidding me look. You know, all that is good. But perhaps the most crucial member of the cast and why this movie works so well, or one of the reasons why this movie works so well, is Glenn Headley. Now, she was pretty much an unknown at this point. She was mostly known as a theater actress. She was part of the Chicago Steppenwolf Theater, from which also arose such talents as John Malkovich, Gary Sinise, Laurie Metcalf, and then later, of course, Philip Seymour Hoffman. But she hadn't done that many movies up to this point. She was in a movie called Elaney with John Malkovich and Kate Nelligan. And she had been in one of Robert Benton's middling projects, Nadine, with Kim Basinger in the title role and Jeff Bridges. But this was her first big role. And because of that, you know, the reveal that she's been conning Kane and Martin all along comes as that much more of a surprise. And she plays the innocent act beautifully in this movie. And then when she goes into the con artist bit at the end of the movie, that really works for me. Claude, I see you frowning there. Do you not agree?
I kind of suspected that she was the jackal, frankly, especially okay. When in the casino, when Andre says something to Lawrence about the jackal and basically alluding to the possibility that Freddy is the jackal. And I said, this might be a little bit of a misdirect. And sure enough, the next thing we see is Janet in the casino, and the scam doesn't go right immediately because she's supposed to lose. All right. That's part of the scam. Okay. Because they're betting
actually,
on the same number.
Lawrence is supposed to lose.
Right. But the thing is, but he's betting on the same numbers that she's betting
yes,
on. So if he wins, if she wins, he wins, so he can't advance the scam.
Yeah.
So she wins, and then they bet on a different number, and they both win again. So,
yes.
And that's why he makes that comment when he's cashing in his chips about, like, what a failure the evening has been, even as somebody's handing him big wads of cash.
Yes.
So, but it wasn't necessarily there that I said, this is the jackal. But, I don't know, a little bit deeper into the story, I was like, something's not quite right, and I don't think that Freddie is the jackal here. I think it's somebody else. Could it be Janet? I don't know. We'll wait and see. So I didn't tweak to it right away, but I thought that something wasn't quite there.
Did you see this in the theaters when it first came out?
No, I did not, actually. And I don't really know why.
I saw it in the theaters when it first came out. So I would have been 21 at the time, approaching 22. So, you know, again, as I mentioned in a couple previous episodes, when I saw No Way Out in the theater, you know, I was not yet, you know, entirely sophisticated in my critical acumen. So probably that's why I did not twig onto the fact that she was secretly conning them all along. Whereas if I saw this movie for the first time today, or even 10 or 15 years ago, I might have cottoned on to the fact. But, you know, my brothers and I saw this together in the theater, and none of us, they're both younger, by the way, none of us saw that coming, and we all thought it was hysterical and great. So maybe it was just our age, but, you know, we didn't see it coming.
Our age, and you know, I think about this once in a while, is as you start to watch films with a little bit more of a critical eye, I think once in a while, like sometimes the cracks start to show as far as filmmaking and television making and that kind of thing. So you start to see where like certain story beats are happening. And so I think, and I, God, this sounds so pretentious. It really does. But you do get like a little bit more of sophistication when you're putting these things together.
That's not pretentious. You know, that is true. And that's why when a movie does surprise you, even after you've gained all that sophistication, that makes it all the more sweeter. You know, the fact that they're able to fool even me, even though I've caught on to this. Like, for example, The Prestige. Even though I thought I had seen it all, that movie did actually fool me. So at the end, but. Another reason why I think this movie works so well is that cinematographer that I did not mention before, but I'll mention him now, Michael Ballhaus. Mm-hmm. He gives this movie an elegant look, which is what Frank Oz wanted, because I have the DVD with his commentary on it. But he knows how to shoot the comedy to make it funny, unlike Ralph Levy. So the scenes where Martin is doing his physical comedy bits, or when he's shooting Michael Caine's reaction shots, and we should also, of course, mention the editors here, Stephen A. Rotter and William Scharf. He stages all of those scenes so well so that they look funny, unlike in the original, where anything that David Niven or Marlon Brando were doing does not come off as funny simply because those scenes aren't shot well. And, you know, a perfect example of that is the montage scene that we get where Lawrence is training Freddie to act sophisticated. And he's failing all those times until the very last bit when he actually does show that he can pour a glass of champagne the right way. And, you know, all those scenes are funny because they're just shot so well.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, this actually reminds me, I've been listening to another podcast. Yes, there are other podcasts out there. For the TV show The Good Place, are you familiar with that show?
I am familiar with the show. Okay. I have never watched it.
And it was a conversation about basically editing and comedy. And one of the things that they like to do, because there's a lot of special effects in that show, is they like to do what they call oneers, okay? And that's industry parlance. It means basically when they do a long scene in a single take, okay?
Right.
That doesn't always work well with comedy, because what you need from time to time is the cut to another person to get the reaction shot. Okay, so somebody says something weird, somebody else has to make like a reaction type face. And you see it a lot also in 30 Rock as well. Like somebody will say something bizarre and then Liz Lemon will just kind of make this really sort of face, you know, and it's the thing that makes the comedy work. And in this particular case, you get this nice mix of doing the longer shots to give Steve Martin the room to do that jumping around and whatever he has to do and the clumsy thing. And at the same time, you get the quick cuts back to people looking at each other and going, boys, he's screwing this up. And it wound up working out very well. You know, so much of comedy, especially on film, really comes down to the timing in the editing. And I'll give you one further example is Roadrunner cartoons. Okay. When you see those signs, those place, those points where the coyote runs over the cliff, and now we get the overhead shot of him disappearing into a little dot. And then finally that little poof as he hits the bottom. Okay. Chuck Jones has said there's literally one frame of difference between whether or not that impact at the bottom is funny.
Right. Now, I have a collection of interviews conducted by Rolling Stone during the 1980s. And one of them is with Martin when he was promoting one of his rare non-comedy movies, Pennies from Heaven. Mm-hmm. And he mentioned in the interview that he was getting ready, or he was in the middle of shooting Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, which was his and Carl Reiner's uneven spoof of film noir movies. And he said that, you know, one of the things that he was looking that people should look forward to about that movie is, in his opinion, most comedy movies were crummy looking. And he thought Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid would be an exception. And while I'm not as big a fan of that movie as some people are, I will say that Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is definitely an exception to Martin's rule in that regard, in that it looks great throughout. And I don't necessarily agree with the idea that comedies look crummy. And also, for me, if the movie is funny enough, it doesn't really matter how it looks visually. But in this case, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels looks great and is funny.
Yeah, it does look good. And I think, you know, I think Martin was kind of underselling it there, because I think comedy, especially when it comes to things like parody, which, you know, Pennies from Heaven would have been, is a lot
Pennies
of...
Pennies from Heaven is not a parody.
I'm sorry. Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid. I knew what I was saying. It sounded great in my head. but the thing is, to make something like that, especially with parody, to make it work, it's... you've got to have a little bit of a visual match as well. So if it's going to be, you know, a funny kind of film, you know, it's got to look correct. And yeah, you know, think back to Dr. Strangelove, okay, which had this very good look to it, very sophisticated drama kind of look to
yes.
it. And that's the thing that made it extra funny.
Right. Now, another reason why the movie works so well is the score.
Mm-hmm.
It's by Miles Goodman, but they also had Jerry Goodman, who apparently is no relation. I don't know if either of them were related to Benny Goodman, by the way, but Jerry Goodman plays the violin for a lot of the score. And he plays a couple of pieces of music that you might recognize. For example, during the whole training sequence that I mentioned that Lawrence puts Freddy through, That's Jerry Goodman playing Putting on the Ritz, well-known Irving Berlin tune. And then at one point, he also plays We're in the Money and an old Jerome Kern song called Pick Yourself Up, which is kind of funny when you think about it, because what Lawrence is trying to do when he's pretending to be Dr. Schaffhausen is to get Freddy to pick himself up. And then, you know, although they don't have as much to do in the movie as the three leads, we should not neglect the two supporting players. Ian McDiarmid as Arthur. Of course, McDiarmid is best known for being Emperor Palpatine in the Star Wars movies, but he is very funny as Arthur. I love especially when Lawrence first brings Janet and Freddy, when he's pretending to be paraplegic, back to his house. And we get a point of view shot from Freddy's point of view as Lawrence and Janet go into his house, and we see Arthur looking at Freddy, and he says in a great monotone, "Welcome to hell."
Yeah.
And then also at the end of the movie, before Janet comes back, when Freddy says to Arthur, when Freddy apologizes to Arthur about breaking his VCR and that he'll send him the check, and Arthur just says, "Oh, shut up." So those are great moments. And Anton Rogers, although he is a British actor playing a Frenchman and putting on a stereotypical French accent, you know, he's also funny, especially in the scene where Lawrence is visiting Freddie in prison, and Lawrence is pretending to ask the inspector for mercy, and you know, he just goes over the top saying, "No, no, no, no,
it's impossible." Yeah.
Impossible. And then also when Andre first learns that Lawrence is taking Freddy on as a reluctantly taking Freddy on as a partner, and Andre is suggesting that he get in touch with a good knife man that he knows to actually kill Freddy. And he says, "As chief inspector, I can promise you that the investigation will be handled in an entirely slipshod manner."
Yeah.
So they're both very funny.
There you go. I've been doing research here, like while you were chit-chatting. There is no relationship between either of the Goodmans and Benny Goodman. So, sorry, no. But Miles Goodman is a cousin to Johnny Mandel, another film composer.
Okay. So, do you have anything you want to add before I answer the trivia question?
Well, you know, we like to connect these films to one another, and it turns out that there is a relationship here a little bit. We mentioned up front that you know, Stanley Shapiro and Paul Henning were credited for the script because they had written the original bedtime story script.
Right.
Stanley Shapiro and Paul Henning also wrote Lover Come Back for Doris Day film.
Doris Day, yes.
Right? Shapiro also wrote, was one of the writers for A Touch of Mink, That Touch of Mink, and for Pillow Talk. And if the name Paul Henning sounds familiar, you should remember that he was the guy who created the Beverly Hillbillies, and he had a lot to do with the development of Petticoat Junction and Green Acres.
Okay. Yeah, except for Green Acres, which I've seen a few episodes of, none of which I have seen. Although I do know the Beverly Hillbillies theme song. So let's answer that trivia question.
Okay.
The year before this movie, although they did not share any scenes together in the movie, Michael Caine and Anton Rodgers appeared in The Fourth Protocol.
Okay.
In that movie, Caine plays a British spy who uncovers a plot to by the Soviet Union to set off an atomic bomb on an American Air Force base. And Anton Rodgers plays a British government official by the name of George Berenson, who unwittingly handed over British secrets to the Soviets. He thought he was giving them to South Africa, who at the time some people in Western government powers, not going to mention any names, but their initials were Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, thought that we shouldn't be boycotting South Africa for their apartheid government because they were staunchly anti-communist, and which is why Berenson was sharing secrets with a South African government figure, little realizing that the whole thing was a false flag operation, and he was actually giving information to a Soviet agent. Now, the other movie that Rodgers appeared in that was based on a novel by the same author was The Day of the Jackal.
I had that one right. Yay.
Yes. And, you know, originally I thought that's why they cast Anton Rodgers in the movie as this sort of tribute to him and to Michael Caine, because Michael Caine actually wanted to play the title role of the Jackal, the assassin who's hired to assassinate Charles de Gaulle. Rodgers, by the way, in the movie plays a man who the Jackal picks up in a bathhouse near the end of the movie and then later murders when Rodgers realizes who he is. But Caine wanted to play the role, but the director of The Day of the Jackal, Fred Zinnemann, refused because he didn't want a star playing the role. He thought an unknown actor should play the role of this nondescript professional assassin, because then you'd be surprised by what he does. And while it turned out artistically right for the movie wasn't a big box office hit as a result, although it was critically popular and became popular afterwards. But both The Day of the Jackal and The Fourth Protocol are based on novels by Frederick Forsyth. And I should mention, in Bedtime Story, Freddie is referred to as a jackal or the jackal. So, no, referring to the con artist, the jackal, in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is not an in-joke. It's from the original. Nonetheless, it is kind of a nice coincidence.
Yeah.
So, anything else that you want to mention?
No, I think not.
All right. So, both The Man Who Knew Too Much and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels are available on DVD, both of them with commentary. The Dirty Rotten Scoundrels one, as I mentioned, that is well worth listening to. However, if you prefer to watch both of them online through streaming, then The Man Who Knew Too Much is available to rent or buy through Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, and most other streaming services, while Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is available to stream if you're lucky enough to get either Hoopla or Canopy, if you're lucky enough to get Canopy through your local library.
Oh, it's not on Canopy.
It's not anymore?
Yeah, that's incorrect.
Okay. Okay, but if you subscribe to Hoopla,
that you
you're
can get it, yeah.
able to stream it, or you can watch it with ads on Freevee, Pluto TV, or the Roku channel, or you can rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple TV, and most other streaming services. Now, for our next episode, we're going into part two of our remakes, the Remake Was Better series. And we'll be the remakes we'll be talking about next time are from 1999, The Thomas Crown Affair, directed by John McTiernan, and from 2011, Ocean's 11, directed by Steven Soderbergh. Both of those movies are available on DVD as well. And you can, or and I also imagine Blu-ray also. I'm not sure about 4K DVD yet. But if you'd rather watch them online, you can stream the 1999 Thomas Crown Affair if you subscribe to DirecTV or Hoopla, or you can watch it for free with ads on Freevee, Pluto TV, the Roku channel, or Tubi. Or you can rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple TV, and most other streaming services. And as for Ocean's 11, you can rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, or most other streaming services. And of course, we here at Words and Movies have our own page, wordsandmovies.com. And you can email us with a question or comment at our email address, which is wordsandmoviespod@gmail.com. Or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/wordsandmovies. And I myself am also on Facebook, or the Book of Face, as Claude likes to say, under my name, Sean Gallagher. And how about you, Claude?
Yes, I am on that Book of Face, under my own name, Claude Call. And you can also check out my other podcast, How Good It Is, at howgooditis.com.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks very much for your time and attention, and let's enjoy some closing credits, shall we?
This is your announcer, Alexander Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Ophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Spotify for podcasters. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.